we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Harvey Risch, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Today, we are continuing our weekly series with various interesting and accomplished people. We have usually been talking about science and medicine and COVID topics, but that's really only a starting point of possible things that we might discuss. And if listeners have questions for me, please submit them at americaoutloud.news/pulse. I'm very pleased to introduce today's guest, Mr. Joe Nocera. Mr. Nocera is a distinguished columnist with the Free Press. A former executive editor at Fortune, Joe has written business columns for Esquire, GQ, The New York Times, and Bloomberg. His books include The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind, with Bethany McLean, and Indentured, The Battle to End the Exploitation of College Athletes, with Ben Strauss. And he's also done podcasts that include The Shrink Next Door, The Pirate of Prague, and American Dreamer, Who Was Jay Gatsby? As a New York Times columnist, Joe was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2007. So, Joe, let's begin. What have you been thinking about lately?
Well, today I was thinking about the Trump trial because I was because I was there watching the jury be selected. That kind of restores your faith in America, to be honest.
I know they're going to need a large number of alternates, it appears.
Well, they've already, amazingly, in the space of 3 days, they have gotten 12 jurors. A lot of people thought it was going to take 2 weeks, and it's been much faster than that. And the surprising thing is that people, you know, who basically say, yes, I know about politics. Yes, I don't really like Donald Trump personally, but I can be fair and impartial, and I know that's my duty as an American citizen, and helps preserve, people did say, it helps preserve democracy. I was touched. I was really touched.
Well, let's hope that's the case.
Yeah, for sure. No matter how it comes out.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote recently on D.A. Henderson.
That's right.
Henderson was a major public health figure. I only knew him peripherally, not in person, even though I was in public health, but he was, my understanding, spent the major part of his career doggedly pursuing smallpox to the ends of the earth to eradicate it. Do I have that right?
That's right. Yep. He is considered by many people to be the single most important epidemiologist of the 20th century. His career really began when, he was drafted into the Army, and he was given the opportunity to join this tiny little organization called the CDC. And he jumped at it, and he decided that epidemiology, he was a doctor, and he decided that epidemiology was a lot more interested than being a doctor. And he came under, his mentor was a guy named Langmuir, another famous epidemiologist who really taught him about the importance of being on the ground and seeing things firsthand and trying to figure things out when you were hit with a pandemic. Anyway, when he was in his 30s, the World Health Association concluded that smallpox was no longer right. Many countries had no longer had outbreaks of smallpox, including the U.S.
Well, we were heavily vaccinated here in the U.S.
That's right. That's right. It, very much like COVID, the vaccinated countries did well. The unvaccinated countries not so well. He was drafted by CDC. Basically, told him to go, they loaned him out to the WHO, and he was put in charge of the program to eradicate smallpox. And I think even he thought it was a mission that couldn't possibly succeed. Because at the time, people thought that the only way you were going to be able to do this is you had to vaccinate everybody. You had to vaccinate the whole world, which was, of course, impossible. But he, you know, he got there and they spent over 10 years on this. And they figured some things out. Another important epidemiologist named William Foggy, who was working with D.A. Henderson, figured out that he was in Africa, and if smallpox broke out in a village, they would get word of it quickly. They'd race to the village. They would hibernate the person who had the smallpox, and they would vaccinate everybody around that person, everybody he'd been in contact with, you know. So we would call that today contact tracing.
Contact tracing and ring vaccination, that's right.
Right, and so they basically invented that technique. And surprise, and that wound up working. They did it in India, they did it in Africa, they did it everywhere where smallpox was still a problem.
But yeah, I would point out that that worked because the number of contacts needing tracing were in generally two digits, rarely into the three digits.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And that, yes. And these villages were all isolated also.
Correct. Right.
So yeah, it was, so anyway, I think it was, I'm not quite sure of the year, but I believe it was 1980 that the WHO declared that there had not been a smallpox incident in, I believe, 3 years, and they declared it a disease that was eradicated. Now, one of the people living today don't really have a feel for what smallpox is, but it was one of the deadliest viruses in the history of mankind.
Yeah, the mortality is about 30%, 33%.
Right. And yeah. even if you survive it, you often wind up with pockmarks all over your body. And when you have it, it's very painful. It's been a killer for literally hundreds of years. So this was an extraordinary accomplishment by D.A. Henderson. And well, you can take it from there.
Well, so, you know, what's interesting to me about this is two parts. First of all, his involvement in generating principles for managing pandemics.
Right.
In public health as a whole. And also the history of the smallpox vaccine, which is not as simple as our curricula would seem to have made it.
Right.
That a smallpox, going back to Jenner, worked by, so the vaccine itself was at that time from cowpox. And cowpox was presumably a milder form of a similar organism that generated immunity to smallpox. If you got vaccinated by having cowpox, you got immunity to smallpox. And however, it turns out that cowpox was not necessarily a mild disease on its own and had some fatalities in its use. Mm-hmm. And so this went on through the 19th century. And still, it was widely used, but there was debate as to whether it was worth it, given that it wasn't completely safe. But nevertheless, it was widely used, very reminiscent of arguments we've had during COVID about safety worth the risk. You know, is the efficacy worth the risk? So anyway, this percolates along until 1902, and the smallpox outbreaks in major cities in the U.S., in Chicago, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Cambridge, Massachusetts then comes up with a bylaw saying everybody has to be vaccinated for smallpox, or they would fine a person $5 if they didn't get vaccinated. Well, $5 then is about $150 now. So puts it into frame of reference. Now, then comes along Pastor Jacobson, who says, well, I've already had smallpox. I don't need to be vaccinated, and I'm willing to pay the fine. And they say, no, you know, we are going to go to court and force you to take the vaccine anyway. And that's what they did. And this percolated up to the Supreme Court in the Jacobson versus Massachusetts case, 1905. And the court recognized a few things. First of all, it set basically the standards for what today is called, in legal terms, strict scrutiny. The the principles, it's not exactly the same, but it's so close, one would look at it and say, this is remarkable how Chief Justice Harlan got it there, you know, that you want to do the minimum necessary to solve the problem. You want to be sure it works. You want to be sure it's specific, that it's not arbitrary and capricious, all these kinds of things that are part of legal reasoning now, when you have to demonstrate strict scrutiny, not just if there's a government interest, then you can infringe on rights. So this was strict scrutiny, which today is, my understanding is, it's relevant to things when you're infringing on somebody's civil rights.
Yes, yes.
You have to mount a defense again by strict scrutiny. So Jacobson was kind of like that. And Harlan said, among other things, that the vaccine was widely recognized by doctors as being safe and effective. And I had thought that too, until I've read some more history about this. And there was some controversy at the time. And there was controversy about, you know, does post-infection natural immunity solve the vaccination question, which it should have and does and should now as well. But in any event, that the court at least made principles that says that you can inflict a vaccination if you meet all of these criteria. And then and so this is the smallpox vaccine that evolved through that time that D.A. Henderson was using in his program to eradicate smallpox across
the world. Well, there was another, as I say in my book, I crunch what everything you just said, I crunch into one sentence. I basically say, through improved vaccine and improved vaccine techniques, because the needles also got better.
Yes. Oh, yes. The sterility certainly got better.
And Henderson used to go to these meetings with a needle and plunge it in himself, just give himself a shot just to show people nothing to be scared of here. It was like a double-bladed needle. It was different than
interesting.
A needle. What?
That's very interesting. I don't know the details of the technology from what he did.
Anyway, he was a force of nature. He was a big man, a huge man, very charismatic, but also very demanding. But he was the kind of person that people wanted to, you know, walk through a wall for.
Yes.
And then when he came back to the U.S., he became the dean of what was then known as the John Hopkins School of Public Health. Now it's, of course, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, which is why they're anti-vape, but that's a whole other story for another day. But he always had smallpox on his mind because he started to really worry about bioterrorism. And he was invited to some meetings, highly secretive meetings, with a Russian defector from Russia's bioweapons lab. And the man said that they were, you know, working on bioweapons using the smallpox virus and anthrax. Russia and America at that point were the only two countries in the world that still had some of the smallpox virus left. Everyone else had destroyed it. So that became his overriding thinking, which also, though, led him to be thinking a lot about pandemics. Because, you know, if you did have, if smallpox was used as a bioweapon, it would lead to a pandemic. And right. And so he...
Well, if it were one that escaped from the vaccine immunity that's very widespread in the world today, at least in people my age and maybe a little younger.
So, you know, there's a very, I heard, you know, Margaret Hamburg and several others who were around, you know, at the in the Clinton days and so on, you know, they told me that the feds, the FBI, the CIA, they didn't really understand what pandemic meant. They kind of thought it meant you shoot at something, you bring it down. They didn't really get how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we have, the famous, I'm sure you've heard of this, the famous dark winter exercise.
I've heard of where, that. I don't know the details.
Yeah. So Tara O'Toole, who was Henderson's number two for many years, she ran this thing called Dark Winter. And Sam Nunn played the president. And, you know, they had different people playing everything. And they wanted to show what it would happen if a pandemic hit the U.S., smallpox pandemic. And they called the thing off after a day and a half because it had spread to 25 states and like four countries in a day and a half.
Of course.
So Sam Nunn then testified before Congress about this. And he said, we would have been more comfortable with a nuclear bomb.
Well,
because
that's
what they understood. That's what they understood.
But they were right, because a nuclear bomb, while it's terrifically damaging, is circumscribed. An infection is not circumscribed. An infection will get out to whoever carries it, to whatever, you know, if it's a human infection or if it's in animal reservoirs, however it gets out, it will get out and spread. And this is the whole point of the fallacy of thinking you have to have a biowarfare industry to protect against some other country's nefarious biowarfare industry. Because if we were attacked with smallpox or anthrax, it would not make sense to unleash something else on them, because it'll hit us back too.
Right.
So either way, you go after them with economic, conventional, or nuclear weapons. You don't go after them with a bioweapon. It makes no sense to go to use a bioweapon in reverse.
Yep. I agree. And Henderson were actually always trying to get America to destroy its own stock of smallpox virus. And there were discussions about this in the White House for years. And then George W. Bush finally said, no, we're not going to get rid of it. That was also around the same time.
So this is a problem because, you know, we signed the 1975 Bioweapons Treaty. This was Ford signed that.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed, therefore, not to be doing offensive bioweapons research and development.
Right.
That was a lie, because we continued doing it. And actually, we got to take
the Russians.
Yes, of course. Let's take a break here. We'll come right back. So everybody, please stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill, it's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Mr. Joe Nocera. So we were just talking about the 1975 Bioweapons Treaty that the U.S. and other countries signed. There was a loophole in the treaty. The loophole was that one could develop small quantities of bioweapons for the purpose of making vaccines.
Right. That's right.
And so we, of course, enlarged that loophole gigantically by just doing the bioweapons development And as far as I understand, from 50 years worth of bioweapons research until COVID, there was never a vaccine that actually was developed based on that research. There were plenty of vaccines made through all of that time, obviously, but nothing that was made as an end result of bioweapons development by all of our nefarious bioweapons industry scientists until COVID. And of course, this is my hypothesis that the whole reason that it was COVID response was militarized was the bioweapons industry was afraid it was going to be ended because there will be so much public outrage about we caused the pandemic in the first place by teaching the Chinese how to make this damaging virus, and then they made it on conditions that were not secure, and it got out from there. This was all a man-made problem that was based on our research. And
I don't really necessarily agree with your view of why the U.S. response was so what is the word you use? Weaponized or
draconian?
Draconian, yeah, I know it was draconian. I think it had more to do with a psychological effect that took place around the world after China shut down Wuhan and claimed that it was working, and it just became gospel, especially after Ferguson in England came out with his crazy numbers about how many people would die in a matter of months if we didn't lock down. You know, lockdown grew out of modeling. Lockdowns were a function of modelers who said, if you lock down, the model shows that the disease will, the virus will go away, which of course turned out to be completely untrue.
Well,
and
the reason why down, right.
Said,
but the reason it was untrue is because it was too late. There were already a million cases in the U.S. by the time we locked down. So there was no possible way that you could contain that.
Well, do you think it could have been contained if they got serious about it in January instead of March?
No, probably in December. That this was already here and unrecognized in small amounts in various places. Don't forget that the one avenue that this expanded was that Wuhan is one of the major garment industry centers in China, and there's a large Chinese community in Milan in Italy that shuttles back and forth because Milan is Italy's garment center.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go back and forth. And so they brought the infection from Wuhan to Milan, and it spread in northern Italy. By the time anybody knew this was happening, the cat was out of the bag. You know, there was nothing, no way you could put this back in.
But let me tell you why. So I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist. I wrote a book about COVID, and early on in my research, I stumbled across D.A. Henderson. And the reason why, I know you know this, Harvey, but I think it's worth sort of articulating. Henderson believed strongly that the way to deal with a pandemic, and he had actually been in charge of the U.S. response to the pandemic in 1968, the way to deal with the pandemic was to protect the immunocompromised and people most at risk, and let everybody else go about living their lives. The least panic there was in the society, the better the society would be. You had to keep in mind that there were other diseases, that there were economic issues, there were this, that, and the other thing. And what happened was, because of his preeminence in the field and his importance, when George W. Bush's administration came up with the country's first pandemic plan, and they were building it around models, and they were talking about, and they didn't use the word lockdowns, but that's really what they were talking about. And that's how they envisioned the society if there's a pandemic. And Henderson fought it. He told them they were wrong to do this. It was the wrong way to do it. And then in 2006,
yes.
I believe,
yes,
before the final report, he and Tara O'Toole and Tom Inglesby and Jennifer Nuzzo, who's really interesting to hear because she was one of the big talking heads during COVID.
Well, same with Inglesby at Hopkins. He was running the group at Hopkins.
They wrote a paper that basically said, this is the wrong approach. The stuff you're thinking about is not going to work, and you'd be so much better off, you know, taking a less stringent approach and acknowledging that COVID or whatever the disease is cannot be, you cannot stop the entire society for this one disease, because that will have, it will cause the population to panic, and it will cause all kinds of after effects that will be deleterious.
That's right. They wrote that paper in 2006. Inglesby was the first author. It set out for respiratory virus pandemic management, the principles, the established principles of how a pandemic is managed. And then as soon as COVID hit, the military took control and did the exact opposite of almost everything in that paper.
I agree with you about everything except the idea that the military took control. I don't think the military took control. It didn't need to take control.
Well, but President Trump handed off control about a week later after the emergency was declared to the National Security Council.
Well, that's because Matt Pottinger was a big believer.
Well, that's right. But so they got involved. The CIA got involved and various subsidiaries of all of that, including the Public Health Administration. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly who the ringleader of all this was, except for the fact that the military was heavily involved in putting out the program of, what I consider propaganda as to what people should do. Don't forget, it took a year, almost a year, before the vaccines were rolled out.
Right.
And as much as it was made to be controversial about the generic drug treatments for early outpatient COVID, those treatments worked very well. They were used in many hundreds of thousands of Americans in almost entirely successfully. All of this was covered up by whatever the messaging that came from the government, the military, the public health, the regulatory agencies, the pharma, corruption and all capture and all that. It was. Can you imagine telling people, go home, and if you can't breathe, then go to the hospital. There's no treatment. Just go home. When there are certainly safe things you could do. Think about vitamin D. If we had a massive campaign for everybody to take in vitamin D, we would have cut the mortality by at least a third, if not a half. That right. The people who were dying on average were older than the average lifespan anyway. Those are people with multiple comorbidities, likely to have low vitamin D levels. And so you can improve people in nursing homes and all that. And they have, their diets are inadequate and institutional food and all of that stuff. And so giving them 6 cents a day worth of vitamin D would have dramatically reduced mortality just in general, and not just from COVID, from other infectious diseases. And yet it was prohibited. It's forbidden to be able to go out and make the statement, everybody should be taking vitamin D. What is vitamin D unsafe? Do we have any toxicity studies of vitamin D at 5,000 units a day? No. So where is the messaging coming from that says not to be doing these simple things that are absolutely safe? Whether we have proof that they're effective or not, we know that they are essentially 100% safe. Why did we not espouse them, and why was there pressure not to?
Well, I just think they weren't thinking. I mean, I think that my view is that the panic was taking place in the government. That's where you and I differ. You think it's a government plot, a military plot. I think it's a case of mass delusion. It's just taken years for some of the true believers to come around and say we were wrong. But some of them are saying that now, not Fauci.
Well, okay. So what do you make of the origin cover-up? The fact that Fauci and Collins and Farrar led your ringleaders to convince scientists not to believe their lying eyes, so to speak.
And by the way, the head of the CDC at the time, right? Is that was Redfield? Is that
his name? Bob Redfield.
Yeah, I mean, he himself said that he believed in the Wuhan lab theory, and he was shut down. He wasn't allowed to talk about it, which was kind of incredible, frankly.
Right. So but my question is, why was there such an immense cover-up for something that would have been no consequence to normal people? And think about who would have been harmed by admitting that this had happened there.
The Chinese.
Not necessarily.
The WHO bent over backwards to not anger the Chinese, especially during the early months of COVID, and said, they're doing everything, they're doing everything right, when they were, they were lying, and they were lying about the numbers and so on and so forth. So, who in the U.S. would, I don't know. I mean, I certainly don't think Obama and Fauci were at Wuhan, as some stupid phony photograph suggests. But I don't have a good answer for that. And that's another one of those things where it was almost like dogma among the public health people and the blue state folk. And, gradually we've come to realize that, guess what? The lab theory is a lot more likely now than some bat in a wet market.
So there were people, myself included, after about 9 months, we had substantial scientific evidence of that it was human engineered. We couldn't prove yet that it was Wuhan, but we knew that it was bioengineered. And this was because of the genetic sequences that are in the virus, that it's not just a furin cleavage site, it's a much longer genetic sequence that also exists in a Moderna patent from 2017. In a gene that is used by virologists, or can be used by virologists, to replicate the virus and to increase the replication of the virus. So this work showed scientifically that the virus genetic code had been meddled with, which means that it had an existence in a lab at some point in its evolution.
So you think Moderna was behind it?
Yes.
Yes. My God.
But you have to realize that Stefan Bancel was CEO of, or deputy CEO of, the French company. I'm blocking the name, but it'll come to me. The French company that built the BSL-4 lab in Wuhan, that it was completed in 2017. It was opened in 2018. He was there in Wuhan, orchestrating the construction of that lab. He knew everybody there. The French were well into this before we knew anything. The Minister of Health in France in September or October of 2019 changed the status of hydroxychloroquine from over-the-counter, it's a harmless drug, was used over-the-counter, to prescription only. And she did this by citing bogus evidence claiming that chloroquine, its predecessor, was genotoxic. Chloroquine had been used in, tens of billions of doses worldwide for 60 plus years. It's not suddenly genotoxic. It's one of the safest medications there is. So she made this bogus statement and changed the status, because they knew from 2005, from the Vincent paper, that chloroquine works against SARS-CoV-1. They knew all this already, and they knew what the organism was that had already started spreading. This is fall 2019. The French were already into this. And so then Bancel comes to Moderna, and so his involvement, this is all innuendo, scientific innuendo, but there's too many finger pointings at all of this stuff to say that this isn't just haphazard.
I'm not, if we were on Fox News right now, my job would be to say, you're absolutely right, Harvey. I agree with everything you say. But in fact, I am not as cynical, I guess, about this as you are. And I believe much more in human fallibility than you do, and I'm a less of a believer in that somebody would, in a very evil way, like Bancel, you know, gin up a pandemic so they could make billions of dollars. I
didn't go that far. I didn't say that this was.
Okay, how far did you go?
Okay, so I said that this could have been an accidental release or an intentional one, and we don't know. Okay. That, but we know that where it came from, the initial cases in Wuhan paralleled subway line 2, which goes by the Wuhan Institute of Virology on its way to the international airport. Okay. You know, there are too many, and there's intelligence information that our intelligence community knows also, and so on. There's a lot of different pieces of things that point to its lab origin and its human engineering that I'm not, by any
means, this was intentional. Let me ask you this, Harvey. Did your beliefs as they were evolving on this cause you to be outcast at among the academics who were your friends?
Well, the biggest thing was when I wrote about hydroxychloroquine after 5 studies that I had reviewed and analyzed together. This was in May of 2020, and I wrote a paper on that, and then I wrote a short op-ed that was in Newsweek saying this is a drug that is essentially completely safe, and whether it works or not, we don't know. We have some evidence for it, but we don't know for sure, but it would be worth trying to see whether it works. If it doesn't work, okay, stop and go use something else, but it's not going to be harmful. There's no opportunity cost if people are being sent home with no treatment.
Right. Right.
So there's nothing to lose. That's what I said. And the astonishing thing is the pushback was, oh, well, here's a study of hospitalized patients, and it doesn't work for hospitalized patients. And I said, I never said hospitalized patients. Everything I was saying was for outpatient use in the first 4 or 5 days of infection, right, not for hospitalized patients a week later, you know. And this pushback all became synchronized, fake pushback to generate controversy and chaos, exactly along the tobacco company playbook, which I lived through in my earlier years. That's how I got into public health, because of pushing back against all of that, the tobacco wars. And
you were involved in the tobacco wars?
Only as an amateur.
Did you know Steve Parrish?
No, I don't. I was in Canada at the time. Garba and some other people up there were in the Non-Smokers Rights Association and various other activities.
Are you pro-vaping?
Excuse me? No, I'm not. I'm anti.
It's sad. You could save millions of lives if you could switch smokers to vaping.
That is probably true, but I doubt that vaping is as safe as one would think. I think vaping is still going to have the cardiovascular effects of chronic nicotine exposure. But that remains to be seen and worked out, and so I can't prove that at this point. But anyway, let's take a pause and for a commercial break, and we'll be back very shortly.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutloud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop. That's AmericaOutloud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Mr. Joe Nocera. So we were kind of talking about, I don't know, a slew of things here as to how we got onto the safety of vaping. I think that you had said as to whether I'm, you know, cynical or not. I try not to be. I try to just, and I try not to be conspiratorial either. But anytime you're trying to make a picture where you don't have complete information, you're forced to make conjecture about parts of the picture. And that's just the way information is, especially when the government isn't transparent and so on. I think that the pharma was highly motivational for getting these vaccines and the gigantic amounts of money that they would make off of them. And so they were the public-private partnership, you know, fascism, if you want to call it that, that we've had.
Okay.
But I don't think that was the true underlying cause of the...
Were the vaccines useful or not?
That remains to be seen. I think not. Okay. I think the problem with the vaccines is that they have a time course that changes over time, both from when they're administered and as the virus has evolved. So, for example, in the first 3 to 6 months, I believe that they did reduce the number of infections and they did reduce the mortality in people who got vaccinated and survived the initial vaccination. However, as things went on, those vaccines lost efficacy in the people who took them, and to the point where in some of the studies it went below zero, that the actual efficacy was never 95% as claimed, because the studies used an eligibility period after vaccination of 14 or 10 or 7 days before an event that happened counted among the vaccinated person. So if people got COVID before day 7 or day 14 after vaccination, those events were put into the unvaccinated group. And the problem is that if you get COVID within the first 7 or 14 days after vaccination, that's not considered a bad outcome of the trial. That's considered an adverse event. But
let me ask you this. You know, there's huge, okay, there are a lot of people who think the vaccines, you know, saved a lot of lives. There's a lot of people who think they were completely worthless. There's a lot of people who think that they did damage. Would you be in favor of some kind of blue ribbon commission or something, or some investigative body that would attempt to get to the bottom of this once and for all? Is that worth doing or not?
If it is, it's theoretically worth doing, but I don't think we could ever do it. I don't think we could ever find people who would be independent enough to be objective. Let me give you an analogy.
I agree with you about that. I think it's one of the sad things about our country. We're so polarized. We're so, just, you couldn't even get, you know, you couldn't find people who could say, I'm going to put aside all my biases and prejudice and look at this with a fresh view. Right. It just doesn't exist in America anymore.
Right. But let's say you have a river and an engineer comes and builds a bridge over the river. And he says that this is my best design. I did a great job. And it's 99.99% safe. Okay. That sounds great. 99.99% safe. And then he finds out that there's 100,000 cars going across that bridge every day. And one of them is dropping into the river day in, day out. And so at 99.99% safe. So the population looks at this bridge and says it's a dangerous bridge.
Right.
Okay. But a person says, well, but I have to go to the post office on the other side of the bridge. Would I go? Sure. You know, 99.99% safe. I'll do that once. I might not want to do it every day, but I'll do that once. So here's the problem. The vaccines were by and large safe for the great majority, but they were unsafe and damaging and harmful for a substantial minority that's small, but not zero. And we have in our history of vaccination never tolerated the amount of damage in a small fraction as large as what we've tolerated in COVID.
Not even polio?
No.
I mean, there were kids who died after getting the polio vaccine.
Yes, but it was still it was still pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
That, and so, you know, whether you argue that myopericarditis in young adults, young males, is a 1 in 200 event or a 1 in 700 event or a 1 in 50 event, there's studies going all over the map on that, that's still, in any of those numbers, bigger than what those people would experience from getting COVID themselves. And because of that, the risk-benefit equation is against their vaccination. But again, it's still a relatively rare event. So the question is, do we as a society think that this harm that we've inflicted at this low but non-zero but low level is worth it for what we've had to protect against? And so the answer to that, it depends on your risk factors. If you're a child, young adult, there's no point, unless you are obese, have some chronic condition that puts you at much higher risk, there's no point. You have no benefit personally.
Right, but here's where the public health, here's where public health people really let us all down. Everybody, not everybody, you know, it's obvious that a person who's 80 has what, geometrically 10, 20, 100 times more likely to get COVID and maybe even die of COVID than a 5-year-old.
Getting COVID about the same, 100 times more likely of dying from it, probably, than a child.
But the country, the government, public health, never made those distinctions. And they always made it sound like your 5-year-old better stay out of school and you better protect him, you better keep him in the house, or he's going to die of COVID, which was absurd and insane. But it's part of the problem is Americans don't know how to deal with risk. They don't know how to evaluate risk, and they don't know how to deal with risk.
Well, and especially if you've been fear-porned, fear-mongered in propaganda to believe that the risk is 1,000-fold higher than it really is. You know,
I agree with that. But not only in COVID, but it's all sorts of facets
correct,
of life.
Correct. So, but the most astonishing thing to me is, I just saw a couple of weeks ago, CDC quietly has been doing these sero surveys. So they've been measuring the presence of virus antibodies and vaccine antibodies in blood and donations of blood from Red Cross. They've been doing this quarterly with a couple gaps, but quarterly for a year and a half, 2 years or more. And so they released all of these quarterly numbers and what they showed from October through December of last year was that 87% of the U.S. population, is their estimate, has had COVID. 87% of the population's had COVID. Now, to me, if 87% of the population has had COVID, then what did all of our measures to combat the spread of COVID actually do? So we locked down to prevent the spread, right? We wore masks to prevent the spread. We did social distancing to prevent the spread. We closed schools to prevent the spread. We closed businesses to prevent the spread. None of that prevented the spread. And vaccines also didn't prevent the spread. Whatever vaccines may or may not have done with regard to hospitalization, mortality, I'm not arguing that point here. I'm just saying that we couched all of these things for preventing the spread of this infection, and now we see that it did not prevent the spread. 87% of the population has had it, according to CDC.
I can't disagree with you. And when you think of some of the really stupid things, you know, I remember not being able to get into the U.S. Open tennis championship unless I had my you know, New York State document proving that I'd had my shots. And, you know,
it's a good thing you weren't playing.
And then it turns out the vaccine does nothing for transmission. Nothing.
Well, it does very little. I wouldn't say nothing, but it does so little that it doesn't help to prevent the spread. Okay. That transmission wasn't studied. And there later on, there have been dozens of studies of transmission in controlled settings. The major one is households. So basically what you're doing is you're finding family units or household units where one member of the household gets infected, and then you look for the secondary attack risk of being infected in the other household members who've never had COVID. So these household studies,
which is why kids would have been better off staying in school.
Right. So there's dozens of these studies, and what they showed is that in the pre-Delta period, so the original and Alpha and whatever they called the virus strains back then, before mid-2021, that the vaccines did prevent did reduce the secondary risk of getting infected. So that means if the person who got infected, in spite of having been vaccinated, that person had lower risk of his household or her household members getting COVID compared to a person who had COVID and wasn't vaccinated.
Right.
And brought to their family. Okay. That changed in Delta. In Delta, there's six studies all show on average that there's no appreciable difference between that vaccinated and an unvaccinated proband, both with COVID bringing it to into their households. The risk in the households is about the same. And in Omicron, the same is true. And a dozen studies on average showing no benefit of that proband person being vaccinated versus not, both bringing COVID into their household. There's also a few other studies. There's a study in prisons done by my colleagues at Yale. There's a study of Chinese bus riders who are in a closed bus for 2.5 hours, things like that. They basically show that the vaccines were inadequate to prevent transmission by the time of mid-2021. So after 6 months.
I realize you didn't answer one of my questions.
Okay.
So, Jay Bhattacharya told me that, when he came out as a dissident, he lost a lot of friends and people send him emails, telling him what a bad guy he was and what a disservice he was doing to the country and how he never wanted to see him at his dinner table again. Martin Kulldorff told me, he got censored by LinkedIn and, he was denounced by his colleagues at Harvard and so on and so forth. So my question to you, I'm going to ask it again. Did you get any of that kind of venom at Yale?
So the answer is yes, but only a little.
Okay.
And after the Newsweek op-ed, one of my colleagues, who's not an epidemiologist, he's an economist, wrote a supposed rebuttal. It was lengthy. He got 24, 25 other Yale faculty, including people in the law school and elsewhere, who have no relationship to anything that of argument, to write on, and posted this on Medium, claiming that I didn't know what I was doing and I was a bad scientist and all this sort of nonsense, and that I was unqualified to be talking about this. And of course, the problem with that is that they had not done due diligence to know that after med school, my PhD is in mathematical modeling of infectious epidemics, and I had published on that, so this was basically a political statement that they thought hydroxychloroquine was a political drug because Trump had said something, in spite of the fact,
that
the French had already known this way before Trump had said anything.
Yeah, that was another problem. Anything Trump said, they would say the opposite.
Right. It was this infantile behavior that they took it on as a political tool. And so that was the only pushback. And my response to all of that was, fortunately, Yale has a very strong principle of academic freedom. They are Yale faculty. They can say whatever they want that they believe, that they think is true. I say, based on my scientific observations and reasoning, what I think is true, and let readers decide who they believe more.
Right.
That's been my response.
And that is a great note to end this podcast on, I would say.
Well, we're getting close, but I think that, it's been a very interesting total experience, because in spite of the fact that there have been plenty of people who disagree with me, I've probably had less than a dozen really negative, combative emails to me. And my email is all out there and easy to find. Mm-hmm. I've had 180,000 emails over COVID.
Wow.
All the rest have been supportive and positive.
No, that's... Congratulations, you're a lucky man.
So the answer to this is that you might lose some friends but you gain others that, you know, that you, your eyes are opened. Yeah. It's a kind of a real awakening as to who people are, who are clear thinking, you know, who are critical thinking, who are at least addressing questions, not being dogmatic about things. And I think that's been very important. That doesn't mean we're always right, but it means we're at least trying to be right as opposed to trying to be dogmatic about it. And it's astonishing how weak the thought processes have been of large segments of the elite, so to speak, the intellectual universe of our universities and our government and our public intelligentsia, that the politicization of this has been so overboard that there's no science there. You know, proclaiming that you're the science was ludicrous at the start.
It's totally ludicrous. It was crazy. And, you know, the thing was that all the people who followed him off the cliff all thought they were following the science. And
well, they were following the science because Fauci had proclaimed himself as the emperor of science.
That's right. That's 100% correct. I agree with you.
You know, but the problem is it's a free for all because now you don't know who to trust. Even when you read papers, you can't even tell whether they're honest or not, because it's easy to hide misdeeds in the text of randomized trials and other kinds of
stuff. Although that's not only a COVID problem. That's a problem all over science. It's a, it's one of the real tragedies. And I'll go back to tobacco. There's so much shit tobacco science out there right now. It's insane.
That would be a whole other conversation. You know, just to end this, the we've worried about in COVID 500,000 deaves in the first year, 500,000 deaves in the second year, and maybe 200,000 deaves in the last 2 years altogether. 1.2 million deaths has been estimated. Tobacco causes 500,000 deaths year in, year out, and it's been doing that for decades. Yeah. And we're inured as a society to that, and our government is inured to that because you can calculate the Social Security payoffs that they don't have to provide, and it turns out to be $100 billion a year that the government saves by letting long-term smokers kill themselves early.
No wonder they don't want vaping.
So I don't know what vaping is going to do, but the economic question here, you know, surmounts any moral questions when it should be the other way around, that we as a society should not be tolerating that degree of damage from an industry, you know, that employs 50,000 people and whatever, but causes this amount of damage. I don't know the answer to that.
I could not agree with you more, my friend.
Anyway, this is great. We're out of time for today. So thank you very much. I hope all of our listeners enjoyed the discussion. If you have questions for me, please submit them at americaoutloud.news/pulse. So Joe, thank you. This has been really great. I've enjoyed it a lot. Thanks everybody for listening, and please come back again next week.